Curse.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 67. Speak and Destroy is a podcast featuring interviews about Metallica, and I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Johnny Christ, bassist of Avenged Sevenfold. This was a fantastic and fun conversation, as I knew it would be. Johnny's bandmate, M. Shadows, was gracious and rad enough to accept my invitation to be the first ever guest on Speak and Destroy way back on episode 1. Since then, I've absolutely been planning on having the rest of the band on at some point, and now I've been able to start putting those puzzle pieces together to make that a reality. In addition to his role as a longtime bassist for one of the biggest and most important hard rock and metal bands of the last 15-20 years, Johnny is also the host of a podcast called Drinks with Johnny. Listen, if you've listened to this podcast or any other podcast, you already know what I'm going to say, which is the best way to support us is to go into Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast platform of choice and leave a 5-star rating and write a nice little review. I mean it. Those really help. You can also visit speakanddestroy.com for more detailed info about all of our guests. You can also support the podcast on Patreon, which means you get bonus episodes from my interview archives, interviews with folks like Glenn Danzig, members of Lamb of God, and even Kirk Hammett from Metallica, who I've had the pleasure of talking to a handful of times. You can follow Speak and Destroy on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also follow me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at Superhero HQ. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. Check out some of the other podcasts in the network like Pop Curse, Musicians Talking Movies, and No Prize from God, featuring conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. So here it is. My conversation with Johnny Christ of Avenged Sevenfold. This is Speak and Destroy.
I wouldn't say I came from a musical household, except for we listened to a lot. My dad had an old beat-up acoustic nylon guitar in the corner that just collected dust for a lot of years, but we'd listen to a lot of music, a lot of road trips. I remember if I was in my father's car and we were driving around, it would be AC/DC, Metallica, Guns N' Roses, and if I was in the car with my mom, it would be Michael Jackson, the Bengals, more the, you know, top 40 radio, yeah. Right? So I kind of had both of those, and I liked both of those. You know, growing up, I was really into music. I loved Michael Jackson as a kid. I used to dance in the corner of my mom's.
And you ended up in a band that's both heavy and melodic. So it's already
yeah.
making sense.
I mean, it kind of worked out, right? Yeah. So I mean, I definitely had both both styles growing up with, which started a very eclectic thing, and then I think I was probably around 12 years old. 10 or 12 years old, one of my buddies had a drum kit that he pulled out of his dad's attic, and he was like, hey, I'm going to start a band. You should play keyboards originally. And I was like, cool, I'll start to learn that. And then we started listening to different music. We started listening to more punk. We were listening to bands like NOFX, Bad Religion, Rancid, of course. Matt Freeman was a huge influence for me. And I started listening to some of that music, and I was like, I'm going to play bass. And heard Les Claypool, Tales from a Tiny Punch Bowl, and it blew me away that was bass guitar.
Right.
And then I'd always heard the bass solo from Cliff Burton, Anastasia, mm-hmm. on Kill 'Em All. Grew up listening to that, not realizing it was a bass for so yeah. many years. And then going back, you know, because before about 10 or 12 years old, I just listened to music and enjoyed it, moved to it, did that kind of thing. But I didn't really study it as much. And then, you know, around that time, I started to study music, and that's that was one of the things that came up. As I said, the Cliff Burton bass solo, Anastasia, Winona's Big Brown Beaver from Les Claypool, Yeah. Rancid and Out Come the Wolves was just popping up. And I just heard, you know, Maxwell Murder, the bass solo that happens at the very beginning of that fucking album. So it was just like that transition just kind of happened around 10, 12 years old. And I asked for my first Epiphone bass for Christmas, something like that. Christmas or birthday. I can't remember which. They're pretty close to each other. November 18th and then Christmas.
Oh, yeah. 25th, I'm November 7th. So.
Oh, nice. Does that make you a Scorpio as well?
All children. Yeah.
You know, that means that our parents fucked for
Valentine's Day.
Valentine's
Day,
right?
Yeah.
Yep.
The math.
It was around that time they had a night, and that's how we came about.
Which explains a lot about the Scorpio way of life.
Totally, man. So, I mean, that's the long and short of it. I mean, I guess I just always had an affinity of listening to music, and then, you know, as I said, my buddy wanted to start a band. I've had to choose an instrument, and I gravitated towards the bass, and haven't looked back since, really.
Yeah, and you know what? One thing that I always find fascinating about Avenged is that certainly from the outside, it's easy to associate. You know, you can see the Guns N' Roses and the Metallica and maybe even some of the Pink Floyd, but also that, you know, the vast majority of you guys, you were also like Orange County pop punk kids. You know, like you were into Absolutely. NoFX and the Vandals and Bad Religion and all those kind of bands, to where, you know, years later when Brooks ends up in the band, the guy was one of those fans that was like, oh, no, that makes sense. You know what I mean? Where it's just like,
you were one of the few. You were one of the few. A lot of people didn't know, because, I mean, a lot of people know him from Bad Religion, but not all of his other work as well.
Suicidal.
Brooks has been since 15 years old. Yeah, he's been Suicidal, Infectious Grooves. Literally since he was 15 years old, he's been a professional touring and in-studio drummer, and obviously has all the chops in the world, can play anything, is a fantastic drummer. You know, he was playing in a punk band that required, you know, a punk beat. And like he did it very well, you know, and he still can do it very well, and it worked perfect for Bad Religion. But then he also had his drum solos and stuff that a lot of people don't go back and watch, but if they did, they'd see him doing ripping drum solos with Tenacious D when he was playing live with those guys, and you'd see, you know, a little bit of what he can do, and then you go back and listen to everything. He literally can do
it. I mean, it's like Josh Freese. I mean, Josh Freese also started, you know, in the Vandals, and it's like, but he's, you know.
And it's funny, they both switch off on the Vandals sometimes. Like if Josh is off doing something else, Brooks will fill in, and vice versa. And you know, those two are really good friends. They grew up together, and it's just funny because they are very much the same person. I've had the pleasure of meeting and talking to Josh several times now, and I actually had him on my podcast as well.
So you're like, am I talking to Brooks right now? Yeah.
Absolutely. It felt a little bit like that. Yeah, sometimes.
Well, Joe Escalante is my brother-in-law, so he's an uncle to my kids. And so, you know, I obviously know Joe super well, and I've met both Josh and Brooks through him over the years. And yeah, it's always like, how are these two dudes not confused with each other all the time? Discographies.
So, you know, Joe is your brother-in-law, you said?
Yeah. So that's incredible. My kid's mom is her sister, Sandra, who's married to Joe. And we live.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm in Los Alamitos. They're in Seal Beach. So we're, you know, we're close by and we see each other all the time. And
I talked to Joe. I had him on the show as well. It's funny. I just like have all my friends on my show. We talked, we drank way too much wine and I had to get him an Uber home, but we've been meaning since, and this was like this is almost a year ago now. And each time we're like, hey, we need to go surfing. We kept talking about how we need to go surfing. We still haven't gone surfing Amazing. Together at this point.
Yeah. And it's funny you said it's a year ago. 'Cause 2020, I keep saying, it feels like it's been about 10 years long. So I'm like,
no shit.
Small world, man. It's a small world and this thing of ours, as they say in The Sopranos.
Absolutely.
I saw Brooks, my old hardcore band in the 90s, played a show in St. Louis opening for Suicidal Tendencies when he was in the band. And I
right on.
Had to have been the only person on that tour to have approached him and asked about Bad for Good.
You asked him about Bad for Good. That's right.
I worked in a record store when I was a teenager. And it was right around the time that Bad for Good record came out. And I knew of them as like, you know, they were these like prodigies that, you know, that was like kind of the gimmick, right? Is they were like teenagers that all shredded. And I remember putting up a Bad for Good display and having like the posters. And and it just, you know, never really took off or whatever. But yeah, he's been around. you're not that old, but you've been around, and that's usually how that happens.
But you are familiar with the cover of the Bad for Good album, yes. Right? I'm sure it's the back, where they're all shirtless and they.
It's very disturbing.
Whatever photographer. Yeah.
Don't let QAnon get a hold of that because.
No.
No, their heads will explode like scanners.
When we found, I didn't know about Bad for Good until Brooks joined the band and we were chatting and we're talking about stuff again. Had him on the show too. might as well just throw that out there. I've had everybody on the fucking show that I know. But yeah, so we talked about that. It was so amazing. I even spliced in on the video, like that back cover, and just gave him so much shit for that. He's had some really weird sessions too. He had like some guy just like kept asking him if he wanted a banana while he was like tracking. It was really weird. Oof.
Yeah. I mean, and which was it? And I always get confused. Was it Steve Vai or Joe Satriani that was like the Svengali of that band?
I believe it was Vai.
Yeah, I remember it was one of the guitar shredders was like, had his name attached to it somehow, which was the only reason I even knew about it back then when it came out.
Yeah.
But yeah, very disturbing that photo. And then there's some other photo. There's some like magazine pinup kind of stuff that I think it's also shirtless 14-year-old.
I didn't see those. I got to ask him if he still has those up on his wall. So
please do tell him.
If he doesn't, I'm going to find one and get it for him and make sure that it goes up somewhere in his house.
Brilliant. So man, we got way off the beaten path there, but, you mentioned Cliff, being an inspiration and you know what, through the trajectory with A7X, you know, there were the Metallica and Guns N' Roses comparisons. I always saw them as, you know, Metallica, if you reverse engineer it, it's Motorhead and Diamond Head, you know, and if you, I mean, there's so many, you know, I was interviewing Billy from him once upon a time. And I remember him telling me in conversation, he's like, dude, my band is just Black Sabbath, Typo Negative, and a little bit of U2. You know,
it's
Chris
great,
Martin has said Coldplay is U2 plus Radiohead. You know, I don't think there's any shame in that. I think what it's about is taking those influences and then you shape it through the prism of the chemistry of those four or five people and then your unique life experiences and then your other influences that come in. And that's how you end up with something new. And so for me, as Avenged was coming up, and especially, I mean, you guys broke through right at the very end of TRL. That was like exciting because it was like it has these elements that I'm familiar with that I recognize, but it's being done by newer, younger, fresher people with a new kind of voice, you know. So there's not really a question buried in there. That's just my take on the trajectory basically.
Well, thank you. No, I mean, all of what you just said is I feel the same way. I appreciate that, and I thank you for saying that. But yeah, we've always worn our influences on our sleeves. Yeah, the main two that a lot of people go to is Guns N' Roses, Metallica. But you know, there's still a lot of Pantera in there. You know, there's a lot of, as we spoke before, the Orange County punk rock that we throw in there. I mean, we've done a bunch of stuff. We do like Oingo Boingo style stuff. We do a country song.
I never thought about that really. Yeah. There is definitely some Oingo Boingo and Tim Burton. You know what I'm talking about. I'm a Danny Elfman style.
Yeah.
I was just talking about him too, because I was just talking about Futurama. That's very true. But you know, as it lines up with Metallica, obviously at some point, and Matt was, as you know, the first guest on Speak and Destroy ever, which was like 3 years ago, which is
that's crazy. Rad. Yeah, I saw that. I didn't see anything about that. You sent me the email of everybody and I was like, oh shit.
Yeah, cool. It was so great. And it was so great of him too, because honestly, it really helped launch the podcast with some credibility by having him on it right out of the gate, you know, pilot episode, so to speak. And I just kind of on a whim hit him up about doing it. And he was like, yeah, come out to the house. And we were in his little studio trying to figure, I hadn't done a podcast before. So it was really, really kind of him and really great that he did that. And it still, you know, continues.
So you went to his house and did it. Did you do video as well?
Just audio. Yeah. It's just great.
He's actually a stone's throw from too. Like, I could walk to his house in 15 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It was probably about 3 years ago.
I should say stumble to to and from his house in 15 minutes. Because I have done it.
Amazing. Just don't fall in a swimming pool when stumbling.
Yeah.
It was so great because it really set the tone, and it really allows me, as I went out and recruited other guests and friends and stuff, to be able to say, well, you know, this guy did it. Kind of elevates it a little bit. And I didn't want to play my A7X chips in too fast succession. So 3 years later, having somebody else from your band on.
3 years later. That's perfect. I mean, that sounds like a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah. But as he and I were talking, you know, he told me a little bit about you guys meeting Metallica for the first time and James and Lars coming out to a show and coming on the bus and that sort of thing. I would love to hear that story from your perspective and, you know, when you first became aware that they were aware of you, how did that go down?
Yeah, man. The first time that we knew they were aware of who the fuck we were on the 20th cycle for Waking the Fallen. I want to say it was 2004. And we were playing the Fillmore, in San Francisco. And I remember hearing that they were going to come to the show. So we got wind. Our A&R agent at the time, Andy Oliphant over at Warner, his brother, Matt Oliphant, was working for Metallica doing art and assistant work. And I believe that's how they got wind.
See, and that's already part of the story I didn't get before. Band.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's kind of where the connection kind of happened, I believe. Also, I mean, we were starting to get some buzz. This was coming off of Warped Tour. And we had just been signed to Warner, so there was starting to get some real buzz behind the band. So I think a combination of those two things was what got them to come out. And I remember just warming up in the dressing room, knowing that they were going to be out there somewhere at some point. And I was like, this is fucking cool. And then we got a knock on the door, and in came Robert and James, if I remember correctly, or it might have been Kirk. This is 16 years ago now. Forgive me for not getting all the details right. But they came in, and I remember warming up. And you know, I had a Stingray Music Man at the time that I was playing. And I remember Robert walking over and looking at it. He goes like, oh, you play the Stingray. It's a good bass, man. And I was like, yeah, I really like it. And, you know, I was all of 19, 20 years old at the time. And obviously a huge fan of Robert's work. And I was just like, I can't believe he just talked to me. And he walks out the door. And then I just started playing as fast as hard as I can during my warm up. I don't know why. I was super jazzed.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we left. And Matt, I believe, was warming up on the bus. And James came and knocked on the bus door and came in and started talking to him about his warm ups and everything like that. So they were very right off the bat. I mean, now we can call each other friends. But at that first meeting, right off the bat, you kind of got the genuine vibe from this band and like how cool and down to earth they still are after, you know, the immense success that they've had over the years. And you know, they could speak to you on such a normal level and relate to you. Like, you know, they came right in and was relating right to us, this little band playing the Fillmore, you know, one of our biggest shows at the time, you know, of our own headlining. Yeah. So it was really cool. That was the very first experience that we had meeting them. And then I remember looking out in the balcony. Again, if you've been to the film or anyone listening or seen it, it's not very far. So you can definitely see where where the whole band was. There was James, Kirk, Lars, and Robert all just sitting up there front and center in the balcony watching us, you know, play songs from Waking the Fallen and Sounding the Seventh Trumpet. It was insane. I was super excited, and I thought that was going to be the last time we ever saw him.
Right.
Lo and behold, they offer us some shows that turn into some tours that turn into, you know, us main support for their stadium, for their first ever U.S. stadium tour. And as I said, now we can call them friends. You know, I got Robert's phone number and text him every once in a while. It was just his birthday the other day, so he's doing good. So, yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, it had to be surreal, like you said, that moment looking up and seeing those guys in the balcony and just that moment of, you know, I'm sure there were a lot of increasingly unfolding new peaks for the band that you're going through at that time. I would imagine it's a bit of a whirlwind too, to try to look back and think about people that you were meeting.
Oh, man.
Places you were seeing for the first time and all of that.
Yeah. Like, as I said, it's hard to get the details on everything perfectly. And some of the stories, especially when you are overwhelmed with emotion at the time. But I mean, but then other things that were going on around it, I remember so crystal clear. like the first time, Waking the Fallen, we had sold 100,000 mm-hmm. copies. We were on the road and we were like, we're going to celebrate somehow. We just sold 100,000 copies of this album. Let's celebrate. And we rented a limo and just drove around and like got some champagne and just drank in the limo. We didn't even go to a club or anything. We just drove around. It was amazing. We were like, we got to do something. And we're out on the road and we didn't have we didn't have much money. So we had to pull together and get that done. And I remember we were just laughing and listening to music and drinking champagne and, you know, couldn't believe that we had sold 100,000 copies of our music. It was a really cool moment.
Oh man. And it's so funny to look back in hindsight with the context of, you know, knowing that you would eventually have platinum records and, you know, the time 100,000 was just seemed so outside of the realm of possibility, like just incredible to even reach that milestone.
Yeah, it really was. Like we had, didn't expect it, you know. I mean, you watch the numbers and you expect it by math numbers, but when it happened, we were just like, this actually happened. You know, we were waiting and waiting and seeing the numbers every week, and then it finally happened. We're like, fuck yeah.
Watching the clock turn, little number turn.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you remember what your first exposure was to Metallica? I mean, you know, I mentioned Anesthesia. Do you remember, and you heard them, you know, your dad was playing stuff like that, heavier stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first time that you saw them on MTV or went to see them live or anything?
My first recollection of seeing them on MTV, and it's funny that you brought that up, was the One video. I remember at a very young age, I mean, I believe that was 89 when that came out. So I was 5 years old. So I remember seeing that music video and it stuck with me. You know, the Johnny Got His Gun clips that they put in there. It was masterful song, everything. I was already a Metallica fan at that point, though. As I said, my dad was listening to Kill 'Em All, Master Puppets, and Ride the Lightning in his Astro van. We were driving around in the Astro van all the time, and we were cranking Metallica. So I can't tell. It would have been somewhere in the Astro van. It would have been something that the first time I heard Metallica and knew who Metallica was. But first video was One, and then my first concert of I've ever been to was a Metallica concert when I was 11 years old. They played the Great Western Forum here, as it was called at the time. I don't know if it's still called that. And I think they just called it
just the Forum now. But
dropped the whole.
We'll go old school.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was actually on the Load tour. After they came back after their break for 6 years after the Black Album, they came back with the Load tour, and that was the first show that they were played in LA. And I was fortunate enough to go to that one. It was my first one. Korn was main support. I didn't know who Korn was at the time. I just saw them. I was like, who is this? And then I ended up loving Korn too. It was a great night.
Indeed. And you know what's crazy? I just was having this conversation with somebody the other day, you know, thinking about Load in terms of quote unquote new Metallica. That record is more than 20 years old now. You know, like that was.
Well, it was amazing. It was, I mean, when you think about it though, too, like at the time, everyone was in an uproar because they cut their hair. Like this was a crazy thing to do at the time. Like 20 years ago, I was like, you don't cut your hair, man. That's crazy. You're not metal if you cut your hair. And it's like, what? What does that even mean? But yeah, it was pretty amazing. And yeah, I remember at that concert, looking back at it, I feel bad for the guys in certain respects. I'm sure they're fine, but there's like sign, like a big ass sign says, don't play any new shit, you know, or something along those lines. And I was a fan of Load. I mean, that's what I was there for. Until It Sleeps is still an amazing song in itself to me.
And it's a great, great bass song too. There's a lot of cool bass stuff going on that song.
Absolutely, yeah, that's a great song. And you know, there's in comparison to some of their earlier stuff, I guess it's different. It's but you know, they're still playing songs now today on their concerts from that record. And people are loving it.
Yeah.
So maybe it just took them a second to get.
And it really changes the dynamic of their, or rather it adds dynamics to their live set now, you know, when they go from Fight Fire with Fire into Fuel, you know, like really does something for the show.
Fuel still slams live every time. And it was like every time it comes in, everyone's just like, even if you were one of those haters at the time when that album, I think that wasn't Fuel on Reload though, or was it on? Yeah. And even if you were a hater at that time when that album came out, you're still probably at the concert now, 20 years later. And when Fuel comes on, you're like,
okay,
I get it now.
You're giving it a nod for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, yeah. you know, when bands make those creative decisions in the moment that are not received as well or take a while to kick in, I look at that more as the great bands that build a catalog where you can look back on yeah. all of the records in their totality and see the different places that they went, as opposed to just, I mean, look, there's something to be said for AC/DC doing more or less the same record over and over. That's one of the things we love about them. But that's lightning in a bottle. I think for the most part, yeah. really great bands, whether it's Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Guns N' Roses even, which is, it's crazy to think about how few records Guns N' Roses actually has, you know?
Isn't that always still mind-boggling to me when I think about it? Because I'm just like, they're so iconic, and you would think there would just be this discography yeah. of so many albums. And I mean, with the exception of the couple of cover albums, you really only have three yeah. albums. And the set, and
if you
the,
think
and
of the, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 as one album, you have two.
Yeah, and it's really only two records.
Yeah,
well, yeah, oh, I'm sorry. I forget about Chinese Democracy. Not that I actually love Chinese Democracy as an album, but I always forget about that one because it's not.
It's far removed, not just in terms of lineup, stuff. But just in terms of timeline. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember
when they reunited with the classic lineup, and you know, I went to go see a couple of those shows. Actually, the second time I saw a mutual friend of ours, James Hart, him and I went to that show in San Diego.
Yeah.
And they do like, you know, a 2.5-3 hour set, and there are so many covers. And you realize, oh, that's
yeah.
there's just not enough material to play that long.
Yeah, I mean, unless they start playing their albums in their entirety, yeah. you know, like, yeah. they do Use Your Illusions 1 and 2.
Yeah,
you know, and it's an entirety,
which is crazy.
No, that's a great point. We did concerts with them in Europe. We did some Guns N' Roses stuff. Axl, it was the different. It was Bumblefoot was playing lead, and I think Brain was playing drums. It was a different lineup, obviously. This was in 2005 or something mm-hmm. like that, 6. And Axl was super nice to us. I mean, when we saw him, you know, he was still coming down stage a little late and stuff like that, doing his Axl thing.
Which you wanted to do. You know, want that to be part of that.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. But, you know, at the end of the tour, we were in fucking Sweden somewhere. Yeah, we were in Sweden somewhere. It was the last show, and we all went to, and the Guns N' Roses guys invited us out to an after party. We went and hung out, and, you know, Axl shows up, and he's like, he was thanking us for being on the tour and had, you know, really nice things to say. And we were like, this is fucking awesome. This is Axl Rose. This yeah. is fucking great. It was another moment that similar to meeting Metallica and doing shows with them, you know, and great, great, great band, obviously. Huge.
That's one thing I really appreciate about Matt is that, you know, obviously Appetite gets its due as one of the greatest mm-hmm. albums of all time. And it's, you know, Diamond Plus and, you know, all the accolades are well-deserved. One of the things I really appreciate about Matt is that, like myself, he really loves the Use Your Illusion records.
Yeah. Same here. Use Your Illusions 2, the blue one for me is the best, Guns N' Roses. I'm thinking Metallica.
Right. Guns N' Roses. Doing the other podcast now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To me, Use Your Illusions 2 is my favorite, but It's by such a small margin yeah. of difference between Use Your Illusions 1 and Appetite. Those are two. I mean, those three records are like, they're all right here. There's just like varying degrees for me of like which one I like more. And I always go back to Use Your Illusions 2. I just, something about the songs on that record and the way that they were, you know, the tone of how they came across. It makes so much sense that they went with blue. Mm-hmm. For Use Your Illusions mm-hmm. too. It feels blue. Like a lot of times music can make you feel or see a color, yeah. I guess, in a way. You don't feel
it. What is it? Synesthesia? Is that the word? There's like a phrase for that for the
way. Oh, is there?
Yeah, I feel or sound. Yeah. I actually, this yeah. is, you know, I think you're a horror movie guy also.
Yes.
So apparently the reason why prior to Freddy Krueger you don't see sweaters that are red and green is there's something about those two colors, those two shades of those two colors stacked up in that way triggers something psychologically in terms of fear. And there was like a whole science behind choosing really? That wardrobe for Freddy Krueger. It's like,
It sounds like Wes Craven fucking getting really into it and figuring something out. Cool.
I like it. And it also explains when I was a kid, I used to look for red and green sweaters and couldn't find any.
There you go.
You know, one of the things I love about the Illusion Records that I think is very analogous to A7X is how much depth there is to those records. You know, I mean, they're layered and they're nuanced and they really go places emotionally. And you know, the songs really take you on a journey, you know, and there's so much, not to the point where it sounds like different bands necessarily, but that they really explore the outer reaches of what's possible within that framework. And I think that's something that your band has done for a long time now, especially. And in thinking about bands in terms of creating dense and diverse catalogs, I think Avenged is absolutely one of those bands, especially in the hard rock and metal space. And a record like The Stage is so demonstrative of that, right? Because coming off the back of, you know, Hail to the King is like a really traditional, straightforward, kind of your Black album, like we're gonna do everything that's great about the hard rock genre on a record and see what happens. And then to then go into amazing, like an experimental concept, super proggy record that has like, you know, Spanish flavors and all this stuff happening, like that, those are the bands that I really love. Sorry, my dog is barking.
That's
okay. When you can Ethel, hey.
I know how this is. I get all sorts of background music.
This is the Zoom life that we're living right now.
Yeah, totally. I know it happens even when I had people over. So obviously now under the pandemic, I'm on the Drinks with Johnny podcast. I've been doing them Zoom as well. But I used to have them in person. But I do it right here in my bonus room, my bar and bonus room, my man cave, if you will. So, and it's open to the rest of the house. So my son would come home from school and be screaming and shit.
my son's been kicking a soccer ball in the living room for the last 10 minutes. Trying not to pause. He's 7. He'll be 8.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah. Then my daughter's going to be 13 in December, which is super.
Ooh, that's crazy. That's awesome. Yeah. Good luck with that.
They're both here schooling right now.
Yep. Homeschooling.
Yeah, I believe my son is possibly doing PE right now.
Okay, that's what PE is now. Kicking soccer ball in the living room. All right, I like it. You got to figure something out, right?
Yeah, that's a very 2020 moment.
Hey, Killian.
Yeah.
You gotta settle down.
You're being way too loud. I'm not encouraged. Anyway, you are one of those bands that I think has that you know, dynamics and depth and different extremes within your catalog. And I also think that, you know, I've often pointed to the User Illusion records as analogous to Avenged. And it hasn't escaped me, you know, being, I think, about 10 years older than you guys, and Metallica being about 10 years older than me, it hasn't escaped me that you guys were coming of age in that Load Reload era. Because I think that there's a looseness and a fearlessness to what you do with Avenged, that you're not afraid of critics. You're not afraid of confusing fans or challenging fans or making them catch up to what you're doing. And I feel like that's a lesson that comes from not only Metallica, but that specific early to mid 90s era of Metallica, where they really just went for it without, you know, I feel like the lesson from them is to not compromise yourself, and then you can conquer the world. You know, I think that's the lesson we all have taken from them, but I see that playing out in Avenged, and I'm sure that the band sees that in you guys also. It's probably why they've taken you on tour so many times.
Yeah, I mean, I would say something like that, and just the fact that we, you know, as we've always said, wear our influences on our sleeves, and Metallica is one of the main ones. And you're absolutely right to point out that, you know, they've even subconsciously seen that, I think. I don't think we ever really, like, consciously set out, and we're like, we're going to do what Metallica did, because they didn't give a fuck, and now we're not going to give a fuck. I don't think that that was necessarily the case, but subconsciously, I'm sure, you know, that seeped in a bit, you know, just, and that also came from the punk rock scene too. You know, we started doing Warped Tours and stuff, and we were like, this is, you get to know everybody out there, and everyone's helpful. And just the fact that we are such an eclectic band, and for our musical taste, that we never wanted to put out the same shit, you know, like we just, for ourselves, we don't want to do that. Like, we're constantly trying to do to outdo what we did before, you know. And whether or not we do is up to the fans' opinions, right? And that's what they argue about on everywhere, and that's fun. That's part of it. It's music, right? Everyone's got an opinion, and you know, it's great. And we've got the greatest fans in the world. It's not up for debate in my opinion, because they have followed us through all that. I mean, like I said, we put out a fucking country record, a song on a record. I mean, like, that's, you know, if you think about it, like, that's not what a hard rock or metal band would do. You know, like, that's just, and not only that, we actually had it be one of the singles on that album and did a video for it, and the fans still fucking request it. You know, it's wild. Our fan base seems to be as eclectic as we are, you know, and I think that's what's so great about them.
And once you establish that trust, the audience trusts you, you know, and every band goes through the thing where the new album that people are upset about because it's not as good as the last one, that album inevitably becomes that album when the next one comes out.
It's the same thing every time. Like, the haters and the new generation of haters, they're all the same. They're because, always going to do the same shit.
They love the record from before that the people at that time hated, you know? So it's like
exactly. So it comes, as you just nailed it. It's once that record is done, the next one is the new one to hate, and now they like the old one, and you know, it's silly, but I guess it's endearing in a way too, though. I don't mind it at all. I think it makes perfect sense because it shows that they were so into whatever record came before the new one or whatever time frame. They're so into it that they no longer can listen to anything else. You know what I mean? Like, that, this is where I live right here. This album is the best. It's never going to get better.
And a lot of it is then, time, you know, place, and circumstance, when and where you encountered something. Yeah. I say that all the time because, you know, for example, for you to discover the band and to hear all of the old stuff very early, but for you to have your first live experience with them be in the mid 90s, you're just going to have a different relationship to what they were putting out then than somebody who, you know, was tape trading and had the No Life to Leather demo. And then they were like, oh, the songs sound different on Kill 'Em All. You know, like, there's always going to be people that just relate to and experience art differently based on who they were when they found it.
Yeah, totally. And I'm sure if I was 10 years older, I would have been one of those guys too.
Right.
No, I can't help when I was born.
Exactly. And you know, and obviously you do your homework and you can study just like everyone does of every generation if they're being open-minded enough. You know, and it gets into the cliche about how all the good bands are gone and there's nothing new that's good. And I like to think that I'm mature enough at this point to realize, like, no, it's just that there's newer stuff that isn't made for me, maybe, you know, or that I'm not designed to connect to, but that doesn't mean that it's of any less quality. I mean, as somebody who loves hip hop, I would say the golden age of hip hop was late 80s and early 90s, and the stuff that comes out now is garbage for the most part. And it's like, well, you know,
it just doesn't speak to you. I mean, that's music, right? It just doesn't speak to you for whatever reason. Again, right time, right place.
Yeah.
You know, if you're discovering hip hop for the first time in the 90s, you're not going to expect that it's going to get any better. That's when you're discovering it, you know, it's not that it's better. Again, it's music. Music is, everyone always just wants to compare it like greatest of all time, like as if it's like an athletic sport or something. It's art. Yeah. Like, there's
you're not counting and measuring it, and especially not counting and measuring it in terms of commercial success, because
no,
you can't do that with films either. Like, oh, well, this Transformers movie was the biggest, whatever. It's like, well, that doesn't mean it's better than, you know, this film that won 12 and Oscars.
That's the whole thing. And that's art too. When it comes to art, it's what speaks to you and what gives you the goosebumps, you know, because there's a lot of people in this world. And if you could even get 1% of them or 0.5% of them to like the same thing that you're doing, you're doing something right, because that's a lot of fucking people.
and communication. Yeah. And it's, to me, what I've learned over the years is that what I respond to really is intention, right? Like, if I get a sense that the art that this person is making, whether it's a comic book or a novel or an album, that they mean it. That's all I want from it. That's all I expect from it. That's all I can get to connect with it, that it's being done from a place of authenticity. It doesn't have to be something that I like. It doesn't have to be my experience. I don't have to agree with it if it's like political or religious or wherever it's coming from, but just getting that sense from the creative side that like they mean it. This is what they have to say.
Yeah.
And that I think transcends the limitations of genre and of success.
I would agree.
You know,
I totally agree. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, I watch, I'm a big fan of Saturday Night Live, and I watch every Saturday, and more often than not, they have the guest. I'm like, I don't know who the fuck this is.
It happens more and more the older we get.
Yeah, exactly. But then some of them, I'll still watch every performance, and I've discovered like newer artists that way because as I'm older, you understand. You got two kids. I only got one, but you know, as your time to discover new music becomes smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's my time to discover new music, or word of mouth. Of course, that's always the age old one, right? But I think it was Saturday Night Live, and then I'll still tune in to the MTV Music Awards every once in a while just to see what's, again, I don't know half of the artists that are on there anymore. It just comes with age. Mm-hmm. It's no disrespect to them whatsoever. I actually find new artists, as I said, from that. Like, Her was on this last weekend of Saturday Night Live. She's phenomenal. I just discovered her about 6 months ago, but then saw her on Saturday Night Live. So I did know her before I saw her on Saturday Night Live, but I mean, her songs are amazing. She's incredibly talented. You know, it's like, I'm going to listen to more of her catalog now.
Yeah.
Like that's like, I absolutely love. And that shows, I like R&B. I like blues. I like pop. I like everything. If it's good and it speaks mm-hmm. to me, I fucking
that,
like that's, it.
You know, SNL still works that way for me too. It's so funny you brought that up, because Ariana Grande was somebody that I had heard of, wasn't familiar with, hadn't heard any songs, probably never would have heard any songs. And then not mm-hmm. only was it her being on SNL, but she was in a sketch. They did this sketch where she was an intern at Tidal, and the Tidal service went down, and so she had to
imitate
every, like, and
I remember this, and she did a fucking
just seeing how
job.
Insanely talented she was made me go like, oh, this makes me want.
Bruno Mars did that skit too. They've done it a couple of times. They did it with Bruno Mars as well,
and
too.
It makes you go like, oh, I should check out what this person's normally doing, because this is.
Yeah, they do a really good Michael Jackson impression and Celine Dion impression. They're probably really good at what they do too.
Exactly. Just when you, but when you can just hear that like innate talent. But yeah, it's great how SNL still exists as a source for discovery. And honestly, even the Tonight Show for stand-up comedians and for music.
Yeah.
A lot of those late night programs, those kind of traditional outlets, will still, if they have the right person booking, you know, it'll cut through. And then I think, again, bringing it full circle to Metallica and to Avenged, I think Avenged follows in that Metallica model of bringing everything up with you, right? Like the big wave lifting all boats, the way that they do those cover songs, the bands that they choose to take on tour. And I think Avenged, you know, casting our minds back to that TRL moment, for example, you were a band that was mm-hmm. bringing like a whole subculture with you. It wasn't just about like, okay, Avenged is breaking through. It was like Avenged is breaking through, and in your wake, you know, all this stuff kind of gets to come mm-hmm. up behind you, you know, that's representative of California and metalcore, if you will, and traditional metal and proggy stuff and all this different stuff that was part of the Avenged stew. And that's always exciting for me in cultural moments when an artist cracks through in one of those traditional places like a TRL or a late night talk show or SNL, and then this discovery comes, you know, all behind it. I mean, it reminds me of seeing Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg on Arsenio Hall back in the day.
Yeah.
The stuff that you discover through one performance of one song, and then you get exposed to all these other rappers and singers. And
yeah, that's a great reference right there. But I mean, yeah, you said it. I mean, I'd like to take, as Avenged, I'd like to take all the credit for that, of course, but I don't think we can. The honesty of that, you know, looking back, it could seem that way, but it's not like we were planning on doing that, you know. Very happy to do it. I mean, and we still, to this day, we still choose whoever comes out on the road with us, same as Metallica. We learned that a lot. A lot of that came from learning from them too. But the whole TRL thing happened because of our friends Billy and Joel of Good Charlotte.
That's right, because they were like hosting stuff for him.
Yeah, so they were, you know, I think TRL I think a lot of people knew that it was coming to an end at some point. They didn't know exactly when, but and before they did, the show's producers asked some of the alumni, if you will, of TRL to bring up some bands that they're really into, and the Good Charlotte guys reached out to us and brought us on one night just to talk the first time, I think, or we played a live thing there, mm-hmm. actually, and then we talked, and the Good Charlotte fans were obviously rabid at the time. You know, they were, you know, they had been fucking retired on TRL for all their music videos 10 times over, you know, with their rabid fan base. And they took to us too. And I think we were one of the last bands.
Absolutely.
Maybe not artists, but definitely one of the last bands that was retired on TRL. And that came from us being on there and doing the performance one time. And then Backcountry got picked up and started being voted on. And Backcountry was, I know, still to this day, probably our most successful video.
Oh, yeah. I and I always associate Backcountry with Sugar We're Going Down. And, you know, it was like in that summer on Warped and TRL Brain. It was like Fall Out Boy.
And we were on the tour with Fall Out Boy when that was happening. And Mike Chem at the time, too. You know, that was like
all three bands. Whole, and we, I was talking about this with Matt, actually. And I remember him saying, yeah, I bet Kevin Lyman wishes, you know, he was lucky that he negotiated all those guarantees. Before the tour started in TRL.
No shit. Yeah. Well, that summer is when we all blew up too. Wasn't, you know, we had already been, you know, everything had already been going. You know, we were already going to do the work for that amount of money. So they didn't have to renegotiate it. But no, I mean, those Warped Tours you can't put a price on like what we got paid for. What we got paid for is the education. I mean, honestly, I didn't go to college. So I consider the Warped Tours my college years. That was learning some real shit about touring life and camaraderie and everything. It was really cool. And the Mike Chem guys being on that Warped Tour, we'd already done a few Warped Tours by then. And I think that was Mike Chem might have been their first one, at least the first one that we were on with them. And we'd already toured with them. We took them out before that record came out, that with I'm Okay on it and everything.
Way early.
I remember we were on tour with them. Yeah, we were on tour with them and we were in the backstage and they were like, hey, this is our new album. We just got pressed. It's coming out next month. Listen to it. Let us know what you think. And we were like, "Oh shit, these guys are about to blow up." and then we were absolutely right. And then you know they went on to
I was actually doing some digging around on Polestar earlier this year, and I was looking at the earliest A7X stuff that they have in their database, and I saw that mm-hmm. pop up. There were a bunch of like early shows for Mike Chem that were with you guys, and it was those old hardcore style bills too, where it's like 12 bands that, you know, mm-hmm. it's a 12 band lineup one day and then two towns over 2 days later it's, you know, three of the same bands and then four completely different ones, like just shows that make no sense in retrospect, you know. And those were proving grounds where you really, you know, some bands stood out regardless of whether or not they seemed like.
Well, Mike Chem always had a great stage presence too, even before their success. Like they were very energetic, very punk rock. Like the way that I mean, Gerard as a front man, you know, when you meet him, he seems timid almost, and then he gets on stage and just turns into a completely different person. He's just an animal, and it was just so awesome to see. And we're like, okay, that energy and this new record. Yeah, this is going to work out just fine for them.
Someday he'll have a TV show on Netflix, I foresee.
Yeah. Oh, it's funny you bring that up, because when this was so long ago that he was still writing the Umbrella Academy stuff. Wow. I remember he was telling us about his comics that he was writing at the time. He hadn't sold them yet or anything like that. They weren't even, you know, they weren't comics yet, let alone a TV show on Netflix. And he was telling me about the concept one time, and this was back in the day when we would share dressing rooms. Bands would actually, there's only so many rooms in the back. So if there's one big one, go take your corner and we'll go take our corner, you know? So we'd be talking back there a lot. And yeah, I remember at the time him describing the stories, and I was like, this guy is fucking crazy. Cause I didn't really understand. And now obviously I understood at the time. Yeah, exactly. Fuck, man. Great. Good for him. I love that dude.
So, bringing us full circle to land the plane. Can you think of any particular moments being on tour with Metallica that were special or revelatory in terms of your, camaraderie with those guys, or, you know, performance there's they saw, or yeah, I'm sure there's a lot, but
there's a lot. And I'll run through a few highlights for me. First being one that I'm sure Matt would have brought up too. One of the first shows that we played with them in Europe, was in Germany. I'm trying to remember where, and Nuremberg. No, somewhere. Sorry. I'll remember it after
of course, yeah. Recording.
but we were, post. You know, we played the show. No one cared about us until the very last song. And then they were like kind of nodding their head. Yeah. It's hard to win over Metallica sure. fans. And then, and then later on that night, they asked us if we'd come on and sing a song with them and do the background chants. And I was on stage that night, like went over first nights after seeing them at the Fillmore, one of our first nights on tour with them. They're like, hey, come on up. We're going to do a Ramon song. And I want you guys to do the backups. And we went up there and we did it. And it was incredible. And then we did it again when Trivium was on the tour as well. It was us, Trivium, and Metallica. They had us come up for another song in Holland somewhere, and we had both bands up there. So all three bands from the show are up there singing along, and I'm over there with Kurt. You know, he's got like 10 whammy pedals out, you know, and his microphone, and you know, they still had stage monitors too, which was wild to think about now. But yeah, it was that those were some that was from the first European tour we did with them. And then this last tour, I say this last, it's over two years yeah. ago now, when we did the US.
I saw that at the Rose Bowl.
Yeah. Oh, you were there? Yeah, awesome. That was a fun show, man. It was great to see. That was like our home show too, obviously being LA. So we had all of our friends are like, oh, you're playing with Metallica? Can we come out to that show?
Yeah. In fact, Brandon from Atreyu was a couple seats over from me.
Oh yeah, yeah. Brandon's a good family friend of ours too. My first tour with Avenged actually was with Atreyu as a co-headliner back in 2002. But I digress. That tour for me was really when we started to become actual friends with the guys in Metallica. You know, acquaintances before, really really nice and very friendly. And you know, being on that tour, and then like. We went to a dinner in Toronto they invited us out to, and it was just awesome. You know, I probably had way too much to drink, but had a blast, you know, just talking to, you know, I was talking to James about the Raiders. we're both Raiders fans. We were talking about Derek Carr and what our expectations were for the next couple seasons and what was going to happen when Gruden took over. It was great. And then, you know, talking to Robert, you know, having a couple glasses of wine with Robert and talking about surfing and, you know, growing up in Southern California on the beach and everything and skateboarding. It was just awesome. Like getting to know those guys on a personal level and having commonalities and stuff to talk to them about rather than just music. Cause obviously you go to music, but yeah, having some other commonalities and some really fun conversations with the guys that has to be a highlight for me for, you know, growing up. Metallica in the Astro Van, first concert Metallica, to now being able to call the guys in the band
talking football.
It's football. You know, it's incredible.
Real life relationship stuff. It's funny to think when you're a kid, you know, fans kind of having these fantasies of like get together and they headbang, you know, and it's like it's actually so much cooler when you realize that it's relationships and humans, you know, just relating to each other as people. And having this great gift of music in common that, you know, creates conversations like this one. But at the end of the day, you know, you and I talking about our kids being home during COVID is just as relatable as talking about how much we love Metallica.
Yeah, no, of course. And that's, you just nailed it. I mean, that's really why I started doing my Drinks with Johnny show. You know, I realized that there was a different perception of what goes on in a dressing room or when band guys hang out and everything like that. It's like, there is of course some of that debauchery and some of that just throwing your head against the wall kind of bullshit that happens, especially in your 20s. But as you start to get a little older, it changes. And I realized there was there's this perception of what the conversations might be like. And I was like, well, why don't I just hit record on what these conversations really are like? And then it started to expand into, you know, I have people that aren't musicians, actors, comedians. I've got some athletes lined up for season 3 because we're going to wrap season 2 here in a couple weeks. And then season 3 will come up. I got some athletes come up, artists, everybody, you name it, wrestlers, professional wrestlers. I grew up being a huge wrestling fan. So going back and talking to some of these guys too, like, and understanding, like, anyone who has a certain amount of success, you can talk to on that level. And like, you know, you start
or touring,
and you just go and, off on that thing,
you know, touring in general, a wrestler. And you know, it's so funny you said that, because the origin story of this podcast and the couple of others that I do is, you know, similarly organic in that, in doing a lot of interviews or writing bios for bands or just conversations, I'm always bringing Metallica up in conversation. And often it's with people that share the same sort of love or have some kind of association or, and yeah. And then I was like, well, that's kind of, that feels like a podcast, you know. That's also the workaholic in me. That's like, I can't just be sitting around shooting the shit. It's got to have some kind of purpose and meaning to it.
Yeah.
And then the same thing happened, you know, I have another podcast that's musicians talking movies, and it's having conversations with musicians all the time that always want to talk about movies and talking to, you know, when I used to be a reporter for MTV News, and my beat was movies. And so many times, even just walking in, having like a shirt on, or they see I have tattoos or whatever it is, actors and directors always want to talk to me about music. And just like, you know, seeing that. And again, that was kind of the thing where I was just like, oh, I should do a podcast. It's musicians talking movies.
That's a great, that's a great concept right there. Well, you have to wait another 3 years and I'll go on that one too.
Yeah, I just did.
No, that's
I just did RoboCop with Blothar from Gwar. And we did it video. Nice. He's in like full costume. And he talked about,
oh, he's, I mean, that's not,
I
mean, a costume.
I mean, he's from the Plants Come Dog. Yeah, he came from Come Dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he talked about seeing RoboCop in the theater tripping on LSD.
So it was, that's, it was rad.
Yeah, I was like, okay, proof of concept. This is working.
Yeah, well, that's what's great about podcasts. I didn't start listening to podcasts until like probably 3 months before I created my own. So I was like, I don't know what the fuck a podcast is. I hear about Joe Rogan and everything, like, you know, 10 years prior. I was like, and then, you know, my buddy Chris Jericho's got his Talk Is Jericho podcast. I was like, been on it a couple of times. And I was like, oh, this is fun.
Yeah, he said yes to Speak and Destroy three or four different times. It just... pinning him down to actually, no pun intended.
Well, you know, well, for the three count. No, you did. Yeah, it's, you know, Chris is all over the place. He does so much. He's got. I don't understand how he can possibly do all the things that he does.
It is totally insane.
Yeah, I'm convinced he's cloned himself, and yeah, and he could be in two places at one time, because I don't understand. I mean, he's a family man. He's doing his wrestling. He's doing his music. He's doing his podcast.
He hosts
all sorts of stuff. I mean, he's just, that guy's
cruise.
Just,
I think he did
always
a cruise.
Doing something. Yeah, he did a cruise. I think he's planning on doing another one in January, as far as I know. I don't know if they're going to have to push it because of the pandemic or not. I would imagine. I don't see it being done.
Yeah,
it seemed like
cruises were the first thing to.
I mean, I guess in theory we could go into it, but I guess in theory, if it's kind of like its own bubble, right? Yeah. If you quarantine before going on there and after.
Yeah, and maybe if it was the first thing where we started really hearing about the pandemic, maybe it would be the first thing to come back to some kind of normalcy.
Yeah. I mean, well, they did a bubble for basketball. I know it's for you know, different reasons, but if you can quarantine for a couple weeks prior to going in and legitimately and like test everybody going on, be as safe as you could possibly do it.
And you're only around people that you know don't have it. So
it's not like you're going anywhere. You're on a fucking boat.
Indeed. Yeah, my introduction to podcasts was more from the movie thing. There were some film podcasts. I actually got asked to be a guest on one, and then this was a few years ago, but that's when I was like, I should start listening to some of these. And then I discovered Marc Maron, and
oh, that's a fantastic
dude.
Podcast.
One day I was having a conversation. This goes back a few years. Our old merch company. So I managed the band Demon Hunter, and we were leaving our merch company after a number of years. It wasn't bad blood or anything. It was just, you know, we were switching merch companies, and I was talking to the guy who owned the merch company. It really seemed to have moved away from music, but I didn't really quite understand what he was doing. And so anyway, I'm talking to him on the phone. It was all cool and everything. But I said, so you don't mind me asking, like, what are you, like, what's your bread and butter these days? Like, who are your bigger clients? And he goes, oh, our biggest client right now is this guy named Marc Maron. And I was like, wait, what? Mm. Like, you do his merch? I was like, I listened to his podcast. And this was probably like 2013 or something. It was a good handful of years ago. And he said, dude, he's the only client that we have that we account to weekly. We send him a statement and a check every week. And I was like, what does he sell? And he was like, coffee mugs with cats on them.
Well, that's a massive podcast. And he's
still
running.
And to know that now, in hindsight and everything, and obviously Rogan and all that. But that was my first real kind of.
Isn't it so funny though? Like now there's like 7 billion podcasts out there now. But at the time, like when like these guys like Mark and Joe had the hindsight to see before, you know, what this could be, you know, and they paved the way.
Yeah, guys like that. You know, Marin's got started because he got fired from Air America Radio. And then he was sneaking into the studio when his passkey still worked at night and just ranting into the microphone with no idea of what
happened. I didn't realize that. That's amazing.
That was the origin of that podcast, which is a very punk rock origin story. And then a lot of those early interviews were him like settling scores with comedians he had beef with, which made them sound
that's
really
brilliant.
Intimate. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the brilliance of podcasts. There are 7 billion of them out there, but each one, you know, some of the ones out there have a cool niche that you could find about. And that's what's, and there's something for everyone out there, you know?
And how much cooler is this cool for me having been a reporter for 20 years? You know, how much cooler is what we just did than us getting on the phone for 10 minutes? And I mean, tell me about
what was it like
working with this guy, you know?
You know, and that's what makes it so much better. I totally agree. That's what I felt comfortable doing, you know, being on podcasts and making my own, because I'd rather have that conversation.
Yes.
You know, I don't want to do the same stupid questions over and over. And it's not a knock on, you know, journalists who have a job to do, and that's what their, you know, what their paper, their magazine wants to read about. But it's not fun for either one of us.
Yeah.
There's gotta be a way to make this.
And I like that this, you know, one of the glass half fulls of the pandemic is that it's forcing innovation. You know, innovation comes out of these frustrations. And I think the more people get used to these kinds of conversations, I think a lot of the stuff that we've seen happen over the last year is going to persist even once we return to some kind of normalcy. I think those.
Yeah, there's going to be some things that we learned along the way that will continue and, you know, for the better, I believe. I mean, being able to do conversations like this and have people being interested in it. I mean, it makes sense, though. I mean, that's what I would want to hear. I don't want to hear the same dribble from my heroes. I want to hear what they're really like.
Exactly.
You know, I don't want to. I know what it's. I've been on the other side. You've been on that side for 20 years. I've been on the other side for 20 years. I know what that conversation really is. Both people involved are not having a good time, and they're just trying to fucking figure out how they're going to put all that information into 10 to 20 minutes. You know,
exactly. Or when they're asking you the first 4 or 5 questions that you know they're just getting through because they want to get to that 5th or 6th question that they know you don't want to answer.
Yeah, they're buttering you up for the one. It's like,
exactly.
Now I'm going to try and get that headline, motherfucker.
All right, I just asked Dave Mustaine 7 questions about his new album. Now can I ask about Metallica?
Yeah.
It's like, that's a dance no one wants to be in. That's
no, absolutely.
That paradigm is gone. I think because it's authenticity that is what people are responding to about podcast conversations and this whole format, because they know that there's a certain, you know, it's canned. There's a certain performance that's happening in those old traditional interview models, you know?
I could be completely honest and candid about it. I knew what I was going to say every time before because I knew what the questions were going to be.
It was I do media training as one of my side hustles with bands, and it's all about helping them figure out what their story is, coming up with talking points, and training them to control the conversation and to turn a bad interview into a good one, and have your, without sounding like a robot, knowing what you as the artist want to get out of the interview, because otherwise it's a drag. You know, it's like political pundits. Like, all right, I'm going to go on and, you know, go on MSNBC, go on Fox News, and
I am the most proud of this record than any other record.
You know what's crazy about this record?
It's different, and
the heavy parts are heavier than they've ever been. But the mold. We really wanted the record to sound big, but at the same time, like that that, you know, to sound live, because we haven't captured what we do live until
See, just right there, you don't actually need to have a conversation with anyone. You already know the answers.
Just start typing it out. Exactly.
That's what I'm going to say if someone asks for like a 10-minute interview when we get back to touring life and stuff. I'll just be like, what are your questions? You already know the answers. No, now that I'm on the other side of it, I have even more appreciation for
that other side. Yeah,
went to school like and understand. I understand it a little bit better now, and I will do my best to never be as salty as I have been.
Well, and you probably understand also on the other side of those occasions, which thankfully I've been doing it long enough that they're increasingly rare. But the occasions when you can tell that you've inadvertently steered the conversation in a ditch, and then you're like,
yeah.
How do I get, you know, this guy hates me right now. How do I turn this around before it's over? You know,
whoop. Well, that's why I drink on my show. I can always blame it on the booze.
Great equalizer. Well, awesome. Well, Johnny, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I've had you on the
Yeah, of course, list man. Thank
since,
you.
Since this thing started. And then honestly, when I saw that you started a podcast, that's when I was like, I'm going to hit him up now.
Now's the time.
Yeah, exactly. All worked out. So,
yeah, man. Well, thanks for having me. This was a really fun conversation.
Awesome, man. Yeah, likewise. Don't be a stranger. And yeah, I'll let you know when this goes up. And someday we'll do this in real life.
That sounds great, man. In person, I like it.
Yeah. Awesome, brother. Cheers, brother. Take care.